Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's time once again to meet our community, the Hispanic community here in Orange County, powered by the Orange County Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and Orange County's only community radio station with the only man who knows everybody, Ruben Franco. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks, Paul. I don't know everybody, but I'm getting close.
I was somewhere the other day, and I said something about the Hispanic Chamber. They went, oh, yeah, Ruben. I'm like, does everybody know Ruben? Yeah,
it's interesting. I've got to meet some great people. One of our guests today is a great person I've gotten to
great
meet.
Great story here today, yeah.
3 years. I think it's been 3 years since you've been, 5 years since you've been dean. Am I doing the math wrong? Gosh, I can't believe it.
It'll be 5 years in January.
Yeah, but welcome, everybody, to our community podcast. And we have a special guest. We have Dean Ian Williamson from UCI. He's the head of the business school, and he's an advisory board member for the chamber as well, and just a great mentor and person to talk to about the business community and the business environment and just great things going on over at UCI. And usually we start our podcast by you just introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about yourself personally. Give us a personal background for us first.
No problem. First, let me agree with Paul. I think you do know everyone. Certainly, that was my experience.
I think he does.
When we first arrived here in 2021, you were one of the earlier people that I met, and it was definitely for you to introduce me around.
Sure.
My background. So I've been here now in Southern California for about 5 years. I moved here from New Zealand. We'll probably get into that a little bit later. With my wife and 3 children. I have twin daughters who actually just graduated from college. So I'm very proud of that.
Yeah.
And I have a son who's a high schooler here in Orange County. And so we've made this our home. But originally from Chicago, that's home for me. And my family's still there. So very proud Southside kid. And we can go into a little bit more about the details of that and all the other pathways later on.
That's great. Your daughter's Howard?
Was Howard that right? University.
Howard University, yeah.
So very proud of Howard. They are now Howard alums.
Oh, awesome.
And they're based out in Washington, D.C.
Great school. And what are they going to be up to doing next?
They are going to work in consulting.
Okay.
So management consulting. It seems like they want to give that a start. And I'm very proud of them. Very happy they have an opportunity to start their career in business.
That's great. I wonder where they get that from.
Who knows where that idea came from?
That's right.
Yeah.
So you came to us before you got here from New Zealand, right?
Yes.
And what was your role there?
I was the Pro Vice Chancellor and Dean at Victoria University of Wellington. This is one of the top universities in New Zealand. Clearly not from New Zealand. It was a very different experience moving there. Loved it. Beautiful country. Phenomenal people. I had a chance to work with just a set of communities that I had not been exposed to, most notably the Maori community, which is the indigenous population there. And we also did quite a lot of work across the Pacific Island region. So Vanuatu, Papua New Guinea, Fiji, really understanding the business community there. And what's very clear, and this is true, I think, for most communities, but it's very clear there, is the intimate relationship between the business activity and community outcomes.
Okay.
And so the business school I led and the university that I was responsible for, a lot of that was around understanding how to position the university as a mechanism of driving economic and social well-being. Another interesting aspect, the business school was literally right across the street from the Parliament House. And so very early on, I think it might have been 3 months or 4 months after I got there, I got a chance to spend time with the Prime Minister, who gained quite a bit of renown, Ardern, because of some of the work that she had done and how she responded, particularly around the pandemic. And phenomenal lady, really gained a lot of respect for her. But we did a lot of work with the government there, helping them understand certain policy decisions. So it was a nice opportunity to see how a university can play a role in shaping not just business community outcomes, but shaping policy decisions for the country. And it's a pretty unique, pretty innovative country. They're about 4.5 million people strong, and they try to get every little bit they can out of everybody there.
I was going to ask you, how big is the population?
Yeah.
4.5 million? Okay.
You put it in perspective, is what, about 3.8 million people in Orange County?
Yeah.
So it's not a lot of people there.
Right. So what happens? One day you get a phone call that says, I want you to go to New Zealand. And then what is the conversation like with you making that decision and you telling your wife about the opportunity?
Yeah. So I got my degree from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And then I started my career. I had a corporate career before that. I actually ran grocery stores.
Oh, you did?
Yes,
How come I didn't know that?
Yeah, so I worked for an international company, ran grocery stores all across the state of Indiana. So I had a pretty meaningful role.
What was the company?
Aldi.
It was Aldi.
Yeah.
It was Aldi.
Yeah,
okay. I was going to guess.
Yeah. Okay. So German privately held firm.
Yeah.
One of the most successful companies you could probably find on the planet, actually. I ran a bunch of stores for them all across Indiana. That was fantastic. But I had, as an undergraduate, I had the opportunity to do some research with a faculty member, really and loved that experience. And I noticed in my professional career, while I was doing well and was enjoying it, I had a lot of questions about why did that happen? Why did that happen?
Sure.
And that's not necessarily the type of questions you ask in typical corporations. They don't really have a business model for mm-hmm. the why. It's more about the how. And I'd made a decision to quit my job and go back to school to get a PhD, which was a big decision for myself and the family, because obviously I walked away from a pretty high paying role to go to a pretty much no paying role.
Sure.
And my father was like, what are you thinking about doing? Like, the whole goal for college was to go and get this job and you're doing well. And why are you walking away from that? But I really had a passion and I thought this would be my calling to do this. So I did do that. And the irony was, after I quit my job and in between quitting my job and starting school, I actually asked my girlfriend to become my wife. And I would not probably recommend that order. Normally you ask before you quit the job.
Sure.
But she said yes. And so we packed up and moved to North Carolina. And that's where I started my training to become a professor. Had a job as a professor at the University of Maryland in College Park, which was phenomenal. Really realized the dream of everything I thought about doing and pretty much thought, wow, this is it. I'm a kid from the South Side of Chicago who's got a PhD and is working at one of the top universities in the world. Who would have ever imagined that? But I had a few experiences which exposed me to things that were happening globally, which, to be honest, I didn't understand. I just never even thought about that. One thing led to another, and I decided, okay, we're going to apply to jobs outside the United States. Now, I did not have a passport at that time. So this was, I never left the country, really. I think I've gone to Canada, but at that time you can leave and go to Canada with a driver's license. Like, I had never had any aspirations to do this. So this was really a moonshot. What are you talking about? Sure enough, I got offered a job in Australia. Never been to Australia before, other than for the interview. But I decided, you know what? We said we're going to give this a go. At that time, my wife and I had two children. We had the twin daughters. So we sold the house, packed up the kids, bought the one-way ticket to Australia, and thought, worst case scenario, we'll end up back on the South Side of Chicago. My wife is also from the South Side of Chicago, and we'll figure it out. But it turned out to be an unbelievable opportunity. We were there for 10 years. We became citizens of Australia, so dual citizenship.
Okay, great.
Yeah. My son was born there. I became the associate dean of the business school there. I was at the Melbourne Business School, which is part of the University of Melbourne. And my associate dean role was the associate dean for international relations. So this kid that didn't even have a passport until he applied for the job was now responsible for leading all of our activity all across Southeast Asia. And opened up an office in Malaysia to support that activity, formed many partnerships across different countries in the region. That actually led to me being invited to become a visiting professor at a university in Indonesia, Institut Teknologi Bandung. Packed up the family, moved the family to Indonesia. And that was cut short because right after I made the decision to do that, I was offered the job in New Zealand to become the pro vice chancellor. And worked out where I could go do a part of what I had promised the Indonesian university I can get done for them, and then left and went to New Zealand.
Wow.
Yeah, and I thought that was it. I did have a little bit of concern. I had left, put it in perspective, right? So America's got 320, 340 million people. Australia's got 25 million, 28 million people. New Zealand has 4.5. I'm thinking, man, the next move I'm probably going to be like on some little island is going to be me, a few goats and a fish looking at me like, where am I going? And then out of the blue, the opportunity was presented to me from the University of California, Irvine, which ironically enough, given I had a pretty exotic career path at that point, I was like, I don't know anything about Southern California. I don't know if I want to move there. And my wife looked at me. She says, you do realize we're living in New Zealand, right? You might want to give us some consideration.
Irvine was more foreign to you.
Yeah, it was. I had never been here before. So I came here not knowing what to expect for the interview. The interview was the first week of March in 2020. So that's relevant because literally 2 weeks later, the entire world was shut down because of COVID.
Yeah, that's right.
I did the interview. I got on a plane, flew back to New Zealand. Of course, COVID hit, and man, I completely forgot about that interview. I was dealing with trying to navigate that university through that once-in-a-lifetime type of situation. And really, several months later, I was surprised when they called me up and offered me the job, because I figured, clearly, they got bigger things to worry about than hiring a dean.
Yeah.
But they were optimistic. They said, we eventually will need a dean. We don't think the whole world's going to end. I was like, that's being optimistic. That's good. And ultimately, I said yes. And we moved the family here in 2021.
And how do your kids adapt to being in Australia and New Zealand and now back? How did they?
Yeah, I
how
think
did they like it, and how are they liking it now?
I think they enjoyed the experience. It certainly gave them a worldview that I probably will never understand. Their childhood versus my childhood. I kind of grew up on the south side of Chicago. It was what I did. It was what I knew. I would have never envisioned the types of things that they've been able to see. But I do think it helped them. I think it was nice for them to have that exposure. Certainly, I think they have a much broader context as what's possible sure. in this world than what I probably would have done at their age. So I'm very thankful for that. And interesting enough, I also think it forced us as a family to become somewhat tight-knit because we had each other as we were going through yeah. that journey. And that's been good, too.
That's great. So you got here at UCI. You weren't sure about it. You
didn't know. I didn't know what I was getting myself into, really.
Okay. But anything here that surprised you about being here?
I underestimated this place in many ways, all positive. I had an initial inkling, but I think I undersold it. So the things that attracted me were probably threefold. One, I did not appreciate, understand the actual business community here. When I interviewed for the job, I did the research and I was like, wow, okay. I didn't appreciate the technology emphasis in this community. I didn't understand how diversified the economy was. And that was actually a big draw for me interviewing for the role because I was like, man, as a business school dean, you want to be at a place where there's a really dynamic business community.
Right.
And this was a chance for me to really see up close the technology sectors that were driving a lot of the activity around the world. And I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. I did not understand the diversity, the cultural diversity of this community. And when I began to actually look at the diversity, I was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. I'd had this career where I had a chance to work with a lot of communities all around the world. That was very important to me. And lo and behold, that was here. And then the third thing that was very appealing was UCI itself as a university. This year, we're celebrating our 60th anniversary.
Yeah.
So we were founded in 1965. And it was amazing to see the trajectory of this university from where they started to where they are today, where we're one of the top 10 public institutions in the country. But despite that success, there was a very clear hunger to get better, to try new things. So I thought, here it is, this university that's been very successful in this dynamic environment, culturally and from the business community, that actually is not resting on its laurels. It still wants to be innovative. So that sold me. And that was the thing I thought coming in. But when I got here, I realized that I underestimated all of that. I underestimated just how dynamic and amazing the business community was. I underestimated just how amazing the diversity of the community was and what that meant culturally and also economically. And I also underestimated the opportunities presented by the University of California system. It really is, in my opinion, the best public university system on the planet. And I know from my experiences in other countries that many countries look at the system as a model for how they want to set up their higher education system for that country. So when I got here and had to experience it, I thought, oh, wow, this is what a cool sandbox this is to play in. So it's been very good. It's been very exciting.
That's great. Yeah, I got to go to UCLA, so I'm very familiar with the UC system. I know Howard Gilman, our chancellor, went to UCLA as well. And yeah, it is a dynamic system. There's no doubt about it. And you said something interesting, just not resting on your laurels, always trying to get better. And you do sense that. It's not in theory. I mean, they are always, every single day, that's something that they do. That's a mission and a charge for everything here. And you see it, you've seen it on campus, just even the 5 years you've been here, seeing what's going on.
When I arrived here, someone asked me, what does UCI stand for? And I said, I don't know. And they said, under construction indefinitely.
Yes.
Yeah. There's this thing of just, we'll continue to get better. And we've expanded our healthcare footprint. We went from one hospital to six hospitals in the last 18 months. The business school has expanded dramatically. We just graduated our largest class ever this past May. And I think we're going to have an even bigger class this upcoming May. And it's just nice to be in a place that is very future focused.
Right.
Where are we going versus focusing on where we've been in the past? We honor our history, but we use that as a leverage point for something bigger, something better.
That's great. I've read you're an expert in human resources management and talent pipelines. Can you explain what a talent pipeline is?
Yeah, so my expertise is around helping organizations attract, retain, develop talent and derive value from talent. And for most of my career, it was trying to understand where in that process of attracting people, developing people, utilizing people, retaining, where were you messing up? Because typically, if you get one of those four things wrong as an organization, you're typically going to have some negative outcomes from a performance perspective. And over my career, though, that logic evolved because I began to think a little bit more system-wide around how is this shaping, playing out in community. And I can tell you the moment where it actually came together for me. I took a group of European business leaders to South Africa. This would have been 2009, actually. And I was there to help them understand how to enter that market and what are the workforce decisions. And we met with several different companies in the region to talk about what they were doing. And in the course of these interviews, one of the leaders said, "You guys are asking us a bunch of questions, but I think you're asking us the wrong questions." I'm the professor. I'm thinking, yeah, I know how to ask questions. What do you think we should ask? He says, "You should ask us what was the first HR policy we came up with when we entered South Africa." And I said, "So what was it?" And he said, "Our HIV/AIDS policy." And it completely floored me. I would have never thought about that. And the context was, at that time, 20% of the population in South Africa was infected with HIV/AIDS. Okay. So you're dealing with a tremendous outbreak. And every single person that worked in every single company there was impacted by this in some particular way. The companies had line items associated with funeral leave and burials and all this. And so I had to actually take a step back and say, up until this point, my focus had been on how to make this company better. But how good can a company actually be if the community around it is struggling? Hmm. And so I repositioned a lot of my thinking to say the goal here is to actually create an effective talent pipeline for the community, of which the companies in the community will then benefit. Because if a community can't attract great talent, if it cannot develop people, if it cannot retain those individuals, if it cannot utilize those people, that community itself will also struggle. And so, rarely that logic has shaped my approach towards leading higher education institutions. I see us as being integral in creating the talent pipeline as necessary for a community to have positive social as well as economic outcomes. We are a draw. We bring students from all around the world to Southern California at the University of California, Irvine. It's one of the reasons why I do a lot of international travel to promote our community to those regions so that they send their great people here. We are a developer. Obviously, we have curriculum and degrees where we're helping people develop skills that are useful for helping them meet the mission in their life that they like to achieve. We help retain them. We're a draw in terms of being a place where people can come and get intellectual interaction and social engagement and the like. And all those things allow the businesses around us to thrive if we're doing that in partnership with them. And so this talent pipeline logic of attracting and developing and retaining and utilizing, that really is a core aspect of how we lead the business school and how I think a university like ours can play a role in society.
And how have you been able to incorporate that into the Orange County community?
One of the first things I did when I got here was I reached out to the business community. So I talked to you, I talked to the chambers, I talked to a lot of business leaders. And my mission and my purpose for those conversations was to convey to them, we are your partner. We will help you get the talent you need if you help us understand what it is you're trying to achieve. And out of that became a mechanism by which we can co-design our curriculum so that the students are able to get real-time understanding of what the things we're teaching them, how they apply to the types of context. And this is large firms, small firms, regardless of industry. And then that leads to consulting projects and experiential learning experiences for our students. That leads to internships. And ultimately, that leads to placement. And then that leads to us being able to do customized research activity to understand trends in business that we want our business leaders to be able to incorporate into the strategic planning.
Sure.
So it really is being very deliberate about that partnership we have with the business community.
That's great. AI has come up a lot recently. Do you look at it as a threat or as an opportunity?
I definitely think it's an opportunity. Our business school, we have two big pillars that we focus on. One is technology, preparing business leaders to be seamlessly able to incorporate technology into their planning. We want our students to think about any problem they're seeing in society. We would think that technology will play some role in helping to address that problem. That's our framing. And so our students should be able to seamlessly think about technology, commercialization, entrepreneurship as being part of the bundle that you bring for how businesses enhance the social well-being of a community. The other pillar is inclusion. And so we want to make sure that we are providing a pathway for members of all the communities that we serve to have a pathway into business and to be successful in that pathway. So I see artificial intelligence as the next wave of technologies that will provide a host of solutions, create new business opportunities, will sunset some business models for certain, but if we've prepared people with the right skills, they'll be able to adapt. So with that in mind, we've leaned in. We have faculty that are using it in their research. It's part of most of our classes in some particular way. We tend to encourage our students to use it as opposed to discourage them. It's forced us to change the way we think about assessment and the like and evolve the way we think about it. And I even have we actually call it this summer in our business school, the summer of AI. So we launched a training program for all of our faculty and staff on generative AI. We're upskilling them to have capability in this particular space. And then out of that, we will challenge them to come up with ways in which we can use generative AI to enhance the services we provide to our students, to enhance our back office about how we operate, to make it more efficient, and even to incorporate more into our research activities. Our perception is this is a transformative technology. It will be part of what we're going to be doing going forward. And we want our students, our faculty, our staff, our community to be very comfortable with it.
And I'm assuming the students have embraced it because they're more technologically driven. How about faculty and staff?
I think in general, people are excited. One of the things that I love about my role in working at a university is there's a certain type of person that wants to be at a university.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think is common is you don't work at a university if you don't like learning.
Yeah,
and so everybody there actually loves learning new things.
Yeah.
And so I think part of the intrinsic reward of working at a university is this potential opportunity to every day learn something. And so what I found is for by and large, the vast majority of our people are excited about, oh, great, the fact that we're investing in the opportunity for them to get this skill. And it's not just something they see on television or hear about in a news report. It's actually something they themselves are getting a chance to play with and using their work. So that's good.
That's right. You invited me to an event you had a couple months ago. I think it was on the future of banking.
Finance. Yes.
And it was great. I'm a former banker by trade. So I thought it was very interesting. But you have a book coming out too called The Future of...
It's called The Conversation on Work. All about the future of work.
There you go. Okay.
And how work is changing. This was the idea that came up, I think, initially in 2022. At that time, the headline around talent management was the Great Resignation. And I wrote an article about the Great Resignation and really pointing out how this was an indicator of some broader structural changes in the workplace and that these changes had been happening for a while, but they really culminated at that moment in time. And really the last 5 years, I'm not going to say unprecedented. I'm sure there's been a lot of other changes that have been very dramatic, but not in my lifetime have we seen this type of change. And you're coming out of COVID. You have the introduction of virtual work en masse with no notice. You have artificial intelligence. You have in the background an exponentially diversifying workforce, a wide variety of parameters. And you also have a true crystallization of the U.S. economy, and particularly the California economy, being a service economy. And so all these things have really just come to bear at the same time. Any one of those would have changed the way we think about work.
Sure.
But to have all five of them happen at the same time really challenges organizations to think, wait, we have to be very different in how we approach this. The book is really focusing on what are those changes? What do they mean for organizations? What do they mean for individuals? And then how are organizational leaders, how should they be responding? And really, that's been a really enjoyable process of thinking about that. I made the decision early on that I was not going to write the entire book. So what I have done is I've curated sections where I lay out what I think are the key issues. And then I brought in short articles from a wide variety of other writers, economists, anthropologists, architects, urban planners, psychologists, sociologists, all thinking about what are the implications of technology, of diversification, of being in a service. What does that mean for how we experience work as individuals? So I think it's a pretty fascinating read. It's designed to be very approachable. It's an airport book.
I'm looking forward to reading it, actually.
Yeah.
So that's great. And I like it when you do get other perspectives from other people that are of similar minds or even different minds that you're trying to get what they're thinking about that. I know, let's go back for a second. You worked at Aldi.
Yeah.
What did you learn from your experience at Aldi going to becoming a professor, to a vice chancellor, to being a dean now. What is there something specific or a couple of things that you learned?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Role? That was a formative experience for me because the retail business, particularly grocery, this is a very low margin business. Yeah. And you make money every day by figuring out a way to get a collection of people to make the right decision. And it's not necessarily big decisions, but it's the cumulative of several decisions. What should we put on the shelf? What should we not put on the shelf? When should we have it on the shelf? How do we get it there on time? How do we make sure that every single interaction with the customer is positive? How do we ensure that the facility is always, it's always going to be something that's going to break? How do we make sure that the facility is appropriate? And it's literally a series of 1,000 decisions every day that you have to get a group of people across a wide variety of locations. I had stores in Indianapolis and Fort Wayne, big cities. I had stores in Peru, Indiana, and Huntington, little small towns. How do I get that workforce across all these different backgrounds to understand the goal of the day, to make the right decision, and to use their discretion appropriately? And if you get it right, we can eke out that 1, 2, 3% margin. If we get it wrong, we start all over again the next day. And a lot of that is the clarity of vision that you lay out, being able to provide effective feedback, how you follow up with individuals, thinking through effective systems, really understanding the nuts and bolts of running a business. And that taught me, that was probably the best field study I could have ever done around that. And then being able to then extrapolate those learnings into how do you create a curriculum? How do you ensure that in an environment like ours, we have all these smart people and all the complexities that we are able to hold true to some notion of a curriculum and a mission that we ensure that each student gets a certain quality of experience and all the various different other decisions that have to happen around that.
So in retail, what drives a customer back to your store? What are they looking for? Why do they want to come back?
It's not that complicated. It's dollar per square meter. That's how you, or square, I said meter. I'm still in New Zealand.
Yeah, still
dollar
New Zealand.
Per square foot. Yeah. You have a fixed facility that has limited space that you're paying a lot of money for. You put something in that space, typically on a shelf or on a hanger or whatever. And if you put the right thing there, the customer will buy it. And they'll come back with the expectation that you will have anticipated what I want. So I'm going to come and I'm going to get it from you. So I need to know what you want. I need to understand how important it is to you, which means how much you might pay for it. I need to make sure that I can get it to you with the right level of frequency. I need to understand that food is a cultural product and your needs will shift based on who you are. Your needs shift over the course of a year. We know that in food, we sell a huge amount of food in America the week leading up to Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah,
but
right.
While everybody has a tradition around food and for every holiday, turns out that every culture has a very different tradition. And so I need to anticipate that and be able to understand what that looks like. And that tradition evolves over time. So it's really spending the time to understand the need of your customer, how they value that, because that speaks to what they're willing to pay. And then how do you provide them to them in a way that is convenient for them? And what we found in that particular setting, and I think the secret of the success of that company, is really leveraging the know-how of their workforce. I would spend a lot of time talking to my cashiers about what are you seeing? What are you understanding? Mm-hmm. These are people with high school degrees. They're not highly educated in the sense of going to college, but they're understanding that my job is not just to be here to take the money it's actually to engage and observe and convey that information so that we get that we have the right thing at the right time at the right price.
Are there any other retailers, that you believe do this right, that you admire?
You admire your competitors.
Yeah.
The Walmarts of the world are great. The Costcos of the world are great. And there's some common themes about how they structure their processes and use information to drive decision-making in those organizations and put a lot of emphasis on leadership development, because you need people at the forefront of the business, the managers, to make the right decisions while managing their workforce and motivate them, create a sense of community. So those are certainly ones that we look to because we looked over our shoulder. Like, we want to make sure,
sure,
we understand what they're doing.
Yeah. You do have to look at your competition and
figure
out what's going on. And I remember Coach Wooden used to talk about when someone said, hey, we're looking at this guy. He likes to go baseline. And he says, I don't care about that report. You just never let anybody go baseline on you, period. So there's just like certain tenets. that you have to abide by when it comes to business or when it comes to basketball or whatever it comes to.
Yeah, and we use the same thing. I spend a lot of time looking at what other universities around the world are doing. So I'm the vice chair of AACSB, is the International Accreditation Body for Business Schools.
Okay.
And so I sit on their board and I serve as their vice chair. And it's a great perch for me to understand not just what's happening here in the U.S., but what are business schools and universities around the world seeing? And that's, I think, a very privileged position for me to be in, one, to help shape the standards for what business education looks like globally, but also selfishly, I then can take that insight to help ensure that our business school here is not just meeting the needs of our local business community, but we're preparing the people that go to our institution to be prepared for global careers, because we've thought about what's happening more broadly.
You talked about earlier about not resting on your laurels, and there's been a debate about school, college education, MBAs, whatever it may be, but what are your thoughts on this debate that's going on?
Yeah, I think the question I get that usually starts is, do I have to go to get an undergraduate or master's degree in business to create a company? And the answer, of course, is no. You can definitely start a company without an undergraduate degree or a master's degree. But what I find is that at some point, if you like to scale that company, if you like to expand that company, you're going to need a set of skills that are very difficult for you to learn through the school of doing. So there's a lot of value in the school of experience. But what I always tell people is you get the experience over, say, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and then you want to do something else. Do you have 5, 6, 7, 8 years to try it and then be good at it then? So what happens is the education dramatically reduces the lead time, the learning curve that you go through in terms of making the decisions that allow your organization to be successful. You don't have to just learn through your mistakes. You can learn through the theory and the concepts and the experiences that we've accumulated from other business leaders that are part of the curriculum. And ultimately, what education does is all of us have our experiences where we can be very effective in one situation. The sign of a world-class education is that it allows you to be equally successful across a wide variety of situations. Mm-hmm. And that's a very powerful multiplier for a person. And when I hear the argument around, oh, you don't really need a college education, doesn't pay off, I'm like, one, the data clearly shows that it does. If you have an undergraduate degree versus not having an undergraduate degree, the data clearly shows, and this is U.S. labor data, that you're going to be twice as likely to be employed, and you're likely to make twice as much money. So those are what the numbers tell you. But one of the reasons why I think those numbers are true is that your skill sets, you're able to have a skill set which allows you to be more effective across a wider variety of situations, which means there's more opportunities for you to pursue. So if, say, one sector or one type of job is in decline, your ability to be effective in another environment is still there. And so, yeah, I think it's one of those investments that the payoff, the ROI on that is pretty robust. That's one of those things that tends to differentiate high versus low performance across a wider variety of things.
That's great. We have a youth chamber that we run here, and a lot of young people that are here at UCI and other universities here locally, and we're a big believer in education. That's one of our tenets as a chamber, education, economic development, advocacy. So how does a young man from the south side of Chicago get to where you are today? How did this happen?
I had a few blessings. I had a fantastic family that put the right guardrails around me, because the environment I grew up in, there was a lot of paths, not all of them very positive. But I had a family that put the right guardrails and the right love and attention into me, and they encouraged me. And then the big breaking point, the big change was I had the blessing of going to college. And I'm the oldest of 6 boys. We did not come from a very wealthy family. It wasn't a guarantee that was going to be something that was going to happen. I benefited because there was a benefactor who I never met who had provided a scholarship for students, and I got some money to do that. And that was the pathway for me. And it opened me up to a whole host of things that I would have never, I did not even know when I went to college that being a professor was a job. Like, this was, how would I know? I never met a professor. And so I got there and I thought this was like a part-time job for the professors, and they were doing something else. Sure, and this was like something they were doing on the side. And it wasn't even until my junior year that I realized, what do you mean? This is like a profession? Like, you do this for a full-time job? And I had a professor who was who's become a dear friend of mine, Dr. Wesley King. He took me under his wing. And he said, let me tell you what I do. And I became fascinated with it. And the seed was planted for me to become a professor one day. Really? So that's how it happened. I had it not been for that mentorship and that exposure, and I got involved in a few summer programs that exposed me to being an academic. The blessing that I had in my life is I had a lot of love and support, and I had access to a world-class education. And had that not happened, it probably doesn't play out this way. But I will say the challenge that I gave myself once I realized that I was getting a world-class education, I said, what's the point in getting a world-class education if you only use it locally? Mm-hmm. And so I said, man, why not think about what's going on in other places? Why not try other parts of the country? And I think it just gave me the skills, but also the confidence to maybe shift my horizon a little bit further, have a slightly bigger dream, maybe push myself a little bit more and have the confidence that, hey, they said they gave you a world-class education. You'll figure it out. That was the pathway for me, honestly.
That's true. If you're in a bubble, there's only so much air in a bubble.
Right? There you go.
So it's like, how much can you grow off of that bubble? And I remember Jaime Escalante, the former teacher that they made the movie Stand and Deliver, used to talk about when he said he wanted to teach calculus to these students, he said they were pushed back on it. They said, why would you teach calculus? These kids, they're not going to learn calculus. They can't even learn regular math. And he goes, you know what? Growing up in East LA when you're 15 or 16 years old, there's a lot of things that are dangerous. Calculus is not one of them. And we have to challenge our students. It can't just be same old. So what is, when you look at MBAs 20, 30 years ago as compared to today, is there anything different about getting an MBA today as there was?
Oh, yeah. We've always had finance and marketing and management. Right. Our understanding of these ideas has evolved dramatically. And you can't separate that change from technology. Certainly, there was a day when we taught internet marketing. Now that's called marketing.
Yeah.
There is no marketing without use of information technology that is of any quality. And today, we certainly are going to have AI classes today. I envision in 5-6 years, that's just going to be finance. Yeah. We had the session on the future of finance. Yeah. We talked about fintech. My sense is in 5 years, that term will have no meaning because there will be no finance without technology. And so what I've seen has been the evolution over my career is how technology that has been brought to bear for these problems about how we identify and resource, how we allocate capital, how we communicate, how we market, how we account for what's going on. All that has evolved. The concepts and the principles, by and large, are still very salient today as they were 20 years ago. But the way we use them, the opportunities to use them, the type of data we can use to check and test our assumptions, that's evolved dramatically. Even in my space, the sophistication around analytics that we can bring to bear about understanding how to manage a workforce looks nothing like what it looked like 20 years ago. And I think that's part of the skill that we want to embed with the students. But we are still talking about business, and business is done by people. There's a humanity side to this. And the psychology and the sociology about how people engage and how we come together to accomplish tasks, we're still pretty much the same creatures we were several hundred years ago, if not several thousand years ago. And so a lot of that, I think, is still very relevant, but you bring to bear different tools to execute on that.
Any big plans over the next 3, 5, 10 years?
Yeah, we're definitely going to continue to grow. We're launching new programs. This fall, we're launching a new master's in management, which is designed to support people coming from non-business backgrounds that are thinking about moving into business backgrounds. So this is your artist, your engineer, your chemist, who have a training in a particular technical area, but they're thinking about how do I make that into more of a business space? Mm. And so this is a great program for them. It's a one-year degree that really helps them get the foundational elements of business. We're launching a new online Masters of Business Analytics. So business analytics is obviously a very hot area with machine learning and artificial intelligence. We have a in-person program, but now we're making a online version of the program, which I think will be very accessible for working professionals or people that are perhaps not immediately in the Irvine region, and maybe it's not easy for them to get here,
right. But
now they have access to that skill set. So that'll be something new. We've been doing a lot of work to engage with community. One of the programs I'm really proud of is our Future Leaders Initiative, which is a high school program we launched 4 years ago. This is designed to expose students in the region to business careers in technology spaces. And it's really about getting them excited about how they can play a role in shaping what the future of business looks like and how technology is shaping real estate or healthcare or finance. And we have them interact with leading business professionals. We take them on site visits to some of the amazing companies we have here. That program started 4 years ago with 40 students. This past summer, we had 150 students. And so we're looking to expand that even more, and that'll continue to be a big part of our activity. And finally, we're a Research One institution. We believe that one of our big contributions is by providing thought leadership to society. We've made a big push in recent years to hire a lot of new academics who are bringing skill sets in sustainability, in fintech, in artificial intelligence. And so we're excited about ways in which our faculty can continue to do joint research projects with local companies to help them answer some of the more pressing issues facing our industry.
That's great. That's exciting stuff. And we could talk about this forever, but we're up against our time, unfortunately. But I want to thank you for being our guest today, Dean Ian Williamson, Dean of the UCI Business School. And I want to thank you for being on our advisory board as well and being the resource and the mentor and the leader that you are here in the Orange County community.
Let me say a positive thing as well about the Chamber. It is one of the most influential community organizations we have in the region. You play a huge role. We love having you on the UCI campus. So we were really appreciative of you taking the invitation to set up your shop.
Thank you guys for inviting us here. You're one of the big reasons why we're here.
And it just means a lot to our students to see the examples that the businesses in the Chamber are setting. And so we're just really proud to have you as part of the community here.
Thank you. And thank you to everybody listening today. And we look forward to seeing you again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Dean.
Wow. Phew. That was a lot to take in a short period of time here. Very impressive discussion today on the future of work and the future of learning and the future of the University of California, Irvine's business, Paul Mirage School of Business, from the dean himself, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live from our studios here at the University of California, Irvine's Beale Applied Innovation Center.